Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more.
Straight talk.
No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
April 22nd, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in New York City, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. As my listeners know, I am a criminal defense attorney in Manhattan. My law firm handles all types of criminal cases, from white-collar frauds to murders to drug cases to drunk driving and everything in between. You can check out our law firm website to find out more about what we do at www.hochheiser.com. That's hochheiser.com. Today's show will feature one of New York State's premier attorneys in the area of sentencing. We will have Alan Rosenthal join us in just a couple of minutes. We will, after we interview Alan Rosenthal, we will then answer the question of the day about an important sentencing provision, which is buried in the penal law, which I bet most experienced criminal attorneys are not even aware of. Then we will be joined by Beth Karras for an update on the FBI forensic hair examiner scandal, which has been in the news over the past couple of days and affects a variety of criminal cases. Before we get to Alan Rosenthal, I want to urge everybody to like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Remember, no G in talking. Email me at talkinlaw@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. If you have guest ideas, if you have ideas for how to improve the show, shoot me an email, talkinlaw@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. Now, the question of the day is, what fifth goal of sentencing was added to the New York State Penal Law by 2006 amendment, which was supposed to help New York become smarter on crime? Alan Rosenthal, you are directed not to answer. I know you know the answer to that question because I stole it from you. Anyway, to introduce our guest, Alan Rosenthal. He is a criminal defense and civil rights attorney with over 30 years of experience. He has litigated cases involving police misconduct and violations of civil rights in both jails and prisons. He is currently the co-director of Justice Strategies, the research, training, and policy initiative of the Center for Community Alternatives. Alan is the primary author of Boxed Out, a report released by CCA last month, which addresses the roadblocks to college education faced by felons during the SUNY college application process here in New York. He's a frequent lecturer and writer on the criminal justice system, sentencing, and prisons. He has become the go-to guy for criminal defense attorneys like myself in New York who have questions about sentencing options and prison programs. Alan Rosenthal, are you with me?
Yes, Dan, and thank you very much for that introduction.
Good morning, Alan. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to answer some questions that I have, particularly about this recent report that was released by your organization, which you're the primary author of, Boxed Out. When I think of Boxed Out, Alan, I think of basketball, but this report is not about basketball. When the report talks about Boxed Out, what is it referring to?
Sure. What many of your listeners may be familiar with in a much more common context is the criminal history box that appears on employment applications, housing applications, apartment applications. But about 10 years ago, it also began to appear on college applications. And in 2010, we were fortunate enough to partner with a professional organization of college admissions officers called ACRO, and we did a national survey, and to our surprise, we found out that almost two-thirds of all colleges in the United States do some sort of criminal history screening, which is shocking when one thinks about the notion of being screened out to go on to your education. Education, the one thing that we know works in transforming lives, reducing recidivism, improving public safety.
All right, so let's start from the beginning so we can break this down for listeners. Let's say I am convicted of a felony in New York State. I serve my, say, three-year prison sentence. I'm released from prison after I do my time. I want to apply to State University of New York, say, at Binghamton. Okay, and I get the application from SUNY Binghamton, and there's a question, have you been convicted of a felony, yes or no, on the application, and I check yes. What's the problem?
So the problem for the applicant is that the roadblocks begin at that very point. Although I must say that as an organization that does a lot of work around reentry, we've come to recognize what we call the chilling effect of that very question. And so the easiest way to explain that chilling effect is a person comes home from prison, well-intentioned, wanting to be able to provide for themselves, their family, and they go out and apply for a job. And they check that felony box, and they never get called back for the job. If that happens 10 or 15 or 20 times, you begin to get the message that the question is being asked to exclude you, not include you. With that as your history, when you then apply to a college and you see that question, for many people, it is so discouraging to see that question in the college context that they don't go any further. For those who dare to go further, what they then run into is a series of roadblocks caused by the supplementary inquiries and requirements that schools such as Binghamton add on to the simple question, have you been convicted of a felony?
All right, so I'm a convicted felon. I want to apply to a SUNY college in New York State. I do the right thing. I tell the truth. It says, have you been convicted of a felony? I check the yes box, and now I get a letter from SUNY which asks me for supplemental documentation about my conviction. What's the problem with that?
Okay. So what we found through a Freedom of Information Law request is that every SUNY school does it differently. There are, in total, 38 differently named documents or pieces of information that the SUNY schools require. Some are very difficult. Some require the production of confidential information, and some are simply impossible to provide. So let me give you a couple of examples that make the point. We found two of the SUNY schools. Most of the SUNY schools require that the person provide their Division of Criminal Justice Services rap sheet. So for criminal attorneys, they're familiar with that. When an individual requests their own rap sheet, that rap sheet includes confidential information intended for the requester only. So it includes sealed records. It includes dismissed charges. It includes youthful offender adjudications that are confidential and so on. But the SUNY schools pull a fast one. They say to the individual, go get your DCJS record and then send it to us. So they kind of circumvent the law. Some schools take a step beyond that, creating the impossibility, which is some schools say to the applicant, write to DCJS, tell DCJS to send us directly your rap sheet. Legally, DCJS cannot do that. DCJS can only send it to the requester or the requester's designated attorney, thereby creating an impossibility. The school then takes the position you didn't provide all of the material that we requested. Therefore, your application is incomplete. Therefore, we don't even pass on it. And that's what gives rise to this very interesting phenomena that we identified for the first time anywhere is the felony application attrition. So 2 out of every 3 applicants who check the box actually end up getting boxed out as a result of application attrition being unable to fulfill all of the requirements.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to attorney Alan Rosenthal of the Center for Community Alternatives. We are discussing the recently released report, Boxed Out, which discusses the nefarious question on State University of New York college applications, have you been convicted of a felony? And the report, which we'll discuss further, has some conclusions about what happens after you check the yes box. Now, we just talked about felony application attrition, which is a phenomenon, I believe, from my reading of the report, that applies to everybody. But doesn't the report make some specific findings about disparate treatment of African Americans who apply to SUNY schools?
So it's important to understand the context of the criminal history question, whether it's in employment or whether it is in the context of housing or education. And that is that if you screen for a criminal history, what you are really doing is disproportionately applying that question to applicants of color. The reason for that, as has been well documented over the last decade in study after study, is that at every stage of the criminal justice system, individuals of color are disproportionately affected, whether it is at arrest, whether it is at making bail, whether it is at sentencing, incarceration, and so on. And so, for example, an African-American male is about six times more likely to have experienced involvement in the criminal justice system than their white counterpart, only a very small part of that being attributable to different rates of criminal offending. And so the criminal history question on the college application will undermine any school's effort to have a diverse student body. That's one effect. But the other effect is that if black and brown applicants are disproportionately screened out of higher education, that further disadvantages their life chances, improving their lives, improving their families' lives, and enjoying all of the things that other people not excluded otherwise enjoy.
Let me play the devil's advocate for a minute. Let's say I'm about to send my son or my daughter to a State University of New York college, and I understand that the state university system has this boxed-out regime where they ask about felony convictions, and maybe I'm thinking to myself, you know what? I don't really want my kid going to college with convicted rapists, convicted armed robbers, burglars, thieves, drug dealers. What does the report say to those voices that say, well, maybe it makes sense to box out the felons?
Sure. So there are actually a couple of very important points to make with regard to that question, because it's a question that we hear frequently. So the first of which is that there is no empirical evidence to indicate that once a person who has been involved in the criminal justice system makes the decision to go invest in their own education, right? So invest in dollars and invest in time. There's nothing to indicate that on campus they're likely to reoffend or undermine campus safety at any greater rate than any other student. In other words, screening out for criminal history records does not improve campus safety. So we've seen over the last 10 years a couple of studies that have looked at that and have concluded that this criminal history screening is not accomplishing any purpose. And part of the reason, when you think about it, is exactly what I said. It's not every person who's going to be released from prison, or every person who served time on probation, or every person who got a conditional discharge and had a felony record, who's going to make this very serious to go on to college. It's self-selected group of people who are making a very serious commitment, and indeed may have been a lot more thoughtful about a change in direction in their life and going on to college, much more thoughtful than we've all been there, the knucklehead 17 or 18 year old leaving high school with very little experience and immediately diving into high risk behavior, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol, whether it's sexual conduct, that somebody with more experience and maturity might not engage in. So I would say to you, Dan, if your son is going and you're worried, you better check his own, not his criminal record, but has he been involved in excessive use of alcohol, drugs, and so on, other criminal behavior, but not been caught, and is he the risk to somebody else's son?
My kid? My kids are beautiful. No problems. In any event, I take your point, Alan. What are the recommendations, before we move on to another topic, but what are the recommendations the report makes to try to correct this boxed-out phenomenon?
Sure. So there is actually a very simple legislative solution. And so there is a bill in both houses, both in the Assembly and the Senate, simply to eliminate the question from the college application, much the same way as we've seen 14 states and over 100 cities and counties eliminate the criminal history question from employment applications, with the one kicker: in the boxed out for in ban the box for employment, criminal history question can be asked once a conditional offer is made. With regard to the legislation that's proposed, and one of the bills in the Senate is S00969. The way that
Alan,
it
that's
work
the New York Fair Access to Education
correct.
Bill?
Exactly. So that, and I've given you the Senate bill number. There's a corresponding bill number with a sponsor in the Assembly. The way that works is the question is simply not on the is barred from any college application, not just SUNY schools, because this problem is statewide and national. However, once the student has been admitted, the school is free to, along with all of the supplemental materials about housing and so on, send out a question as it relates to a criminal history background check, not for the purpose of rescinding the offer, but for the purpose of deciding such things as appropriateness of housing, support services that might be appropriate, counseling as it relates to professional licensing and problems that the person might encounter. It creates some transparency and still allows for the school to use that information, but in a much more constructive rather than destructive or exclusive way.
We're going to, Alan, we're going to move on to another topic from the Boxed Out report, but it's really a fascinating phenomena that is documented in about 100 pages. Boxed Out, Criminal History Screening and College Application Attrition. I will post a link to the report on the Facebook.com/talkinlaw page, Facebook.com/talkinlaw. You can also see the report on the communityalternatives.org website. So, Alan, we've been speaking about the boxed out phenomenon, which excludes effectively certain people with convictions from getting higher education, which is a consequence of a conviction. But let's broaden the question. What are some of the other collateral consequences or lifetime consequences that people with felony convictions face in New York?
Sure. So I'd love to kind of give you a rundown of those. But it's important for your listeners to keep in mind that these are not the articulated parts of the sentence. These are the unspoken lifetime parts of a sentence. And so for any criminal defense lawyer, your client at some point either gets convicted or enters a plea, there's a sentence, and the judge mets that out. And in many instances, that's a much smaller punishment than the unspoken consequence that the person might face. Those consequences may be a lifetime of difficulty in getting employment, a lifetime of difficulty in getting housing, education we've already spoken about, and one that ends up more and more shattering lives is a person may face deportation. So we've created these lifetime consequences that go way beyond a person being placed on probation or a person serving even a few years in prison. Many people would trade and say, I'm more than glad to do the time. What I am concerned about is for the rest of my life. I have this mark on me that's going to prevent me and my family from putting our lives back together and living a law-abiding and contributory life.
So, Alan, at my law firm, we get calls routinely from people who have been convicted of crimes. They've served their time, completed their sentences, and they call up and they say, Mr. Hochheiser, I want to get my New York State conviction expunged. Do we have expungement of records in New York?
Question. And the one that most defense lawyers are disappointed in the answer that they have to give to their prospective client. So New York does not have something called expungement. And it's odd because you just go right over across the river to New Jersey, and a person there, having committed the same offense, right, at the same age as the person in New York, is eligible for expungement. And then when they go out to compete in the national economy for jobs or housing or anything else, the person from New Jersey has the competitive edge because their record has been expunged. So, in effect, what we're doing with these crazy collateral consequences is we're disadvantaging our own citizens in New York, our own young people. Many of these records date back to the time when individuals are teenagers. We're making our own citizens in New York, we're making their lives much more difficult in a national economy.
So the next question we get after we tell the unhappy prospective client that we can't do anything for them in terms of expungement, the next question, of course, is, well, how about getting my record sealed? Can you get a record sealed in New York under certain circumstances, and what does sealing mean?
Sure. So New York has a couple of what we call sealing provisions. For a number of years, we had sealing, but it was for arrests, that were eventually dismissed. It was for violations, so those offenses lower than a misdemeanor, for which there was a conviction. There could be a ceiling, but we had no ceiling provision for actual criminal convictions. In 2009, the legislature created a very limited animal called the conditional ceiling, and so under very limited circumstances, a person convicted of a drug offense who participated either in drug court, judicial diversion, or some other court-sanctioned treatment would be eligible for the conditional sealing of their record. The meaning of conditional sealing or sealing in general is that it is removed. It comes off of your DCJS, your rap sheet. However, if this is interesting because it ties back to the question that I was talking about with regard to the college application. If I request my own DCJS rap sheet, I will receive it, and it will include sealed records. If somebody who is not the requester, if somebody else is authorized to do a DCJS background check, they will not receive the sealed record. It is helpful. It is similar to the concept of expungement, but in New York, it's very, very limited opportunities for sealing.
Alan, we have just about a minute and a half left together, and I could speak to you about sentencing for hours, but unfortunately we just don't have the time. But I don't want to forget to ask you about the presidential race, which is being flooded with candidates. The main candidates so far, it appears to me, are Hillary Clinton for the Democrats and Jeb Bush for the Republicans. I know there are many others, but from a criminal justice standpoint, is there really a difference in policy positions between Hillary and Jeb Bush?
Quite frankly, on criminal justice issues decade, we didn't see much difference between the positions articulated between the two major parties. We did see some of the minor parties talking about reform. Only in the last year or two have we seen some whispers of a bipartisan effort to look at how we can be smarter on crime, what we can do differently, what we can do to undo the devastation wrought by mass incarceration and mass criminalization that has distinguished the United States from all other countries.
Alan
maybe
Rosenthal,
that's the whisper
thank you
of hope.
So much. We're out of time. I appreciate you joining us. Alan Rosenthal from the Center for Community Alternatives. Check out their website at communityalternatives.org and check out their recently released report, Boxed Out. Alan, I'll speak to you soon. Thanks again.
Yes, thank you, Dan.
Now, we are going to answer the question of the day before we go to Beth Karras. Question, what fifth goal of sentencing was added to the New York State Penal Law by 2006 amendment, which was supposed to help New York become smarter on crime? Answer, the fifth goal added by 2006 amendment is promotion of their successful and productive reentry and reintegration into society, which is codified by Penal Law Section 1.05, Subsection 6. So now, in addition to the traditional sentencing purposes of retribution, deterrence, rehabilitation, and incapacitation, New York law for the past 9 years has had the fifth sentencing goal of reintegration. Unfortunately, of the five goals, only three are alive and well, in my opinion. Those three vibrant sentencing goals are retribution, deterrence, and incapacitation. system in New York does not do a very good job, however, at rehabilitation, except perhaps for treatment of some low-level non-violent drug addicts who are diverted from prisons to programs. But in my experience, the average felon who serves their time in a New York State prison is released as an unemployable convict who has not been rehabilitated and may very well fall back into a life of crime as an only option to survive. As to the reasonably new goal of reintegration, I am not aware of any efforts being made by the system to help those released into society adjust to life outside the prison world of iron bars and concrete. Some Talkin' Law listeners may recall our prior guest, Marty Tankliff, who served 17 years in prison, and then when he got out, he went to the Department of Motor Vehicles in New York and had to bring a newspaper article as his only form of identification to start his new life outside prison. I support providing higher education programs inside prisons and creating support systems for those convicts who have served their time and need help reintegrating into society, including help with finding a place to live and work. So I applaud the work that Alan Rosenthal and the Center for Community Alternatives is doing. Now, please give me Beth and Kiss.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karis on Crime special report from Beth Karis, former prosecutor, Court TV HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarisOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Dan.
I missed you so much. I'm glad you're back.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was in Phoenix and Las Vegas last year on business, so sorry I couldn't join your show. But who knew when I filled in for you the week before and chose the topic of forensics in the courtroom that things were going to blow up 2 weeks later?
And they did. It was almost as if you choreographed it.
I know. I do think one of the two guests I had on, just attorney in New York, Marvin Schechter, knew what was up, but couldn't say. Because the Innocence Project and the Criminal Defense Lawyers, National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, has been working with the Justice Department on their evaluation of various forensic techniques and trying to overhaul labs and the systems and the standards used. And last Saturday, the Washington Post broke the story. The FBI, Justice Department are acknowledging in one of the forensic disciplines, that's microscopic hair comparisons, that between 1972 and 1999, they've been looking at cases, 26 out of 28 of their hair examiners gave flawed testimony, and they examined 268 cases, 95% of the time. It's not based on sound science. Everything changed from 2000 forward because they used DNA to help include someone, you know, mitochondrial DNA analysis of hair. But up until 1999, it's shocking. The FBI has developed standards for hair analysis since 2012, and they are going to be coming out with standards for 19 other forensic areas. And, you know, what we're hearing in the last few days is just, it's mind-boggling. Many of the cases are prosecuted by states, not the feds, because these are, you know, many are crimes that, you know, the state has jurisdiction over. So states need to revamp what they're doing. And here's what's really problematic, is in those cases where defendants may want an appeal, not all states, their rules allow for an appeal. You know, a couple of states, California and Texas, do allow a grounds for appeal to be that science has advanced beyond what it was at the time of the conviction, or there's, you know, it's proven to be faulty forensics that it's relied on. But not all states are there.
So, Beth, let's take a step back for the listeners so that we make sure they understand what's happening here. So prior to 2000, the FBI forensic experts were taking hair from crime scenes and comparing it to hair from suspects and making some kind of subjective analysis of those two pieces of evidence, the known and the unknown.
Wait, they
is
would
that
say
right?
It's a match, right? And a match, and I use, you know, that term lightly quotes it. But it was not backed by proper statistics, right? It was sort of incomplete, misleading to call something a match. And, in fact, a quarter of the DNA exonerations, 329 exonerations, more than a quarter of them, had faulty hair testimony as part of it. Do cases rise and fall on hair evidence? Probably not most, but some do. And some cases that the FBI has examined, the 268, resulted in death, and a number of death sentences, and a number of these defendants were either executed or died in prison. So, yeah, the conclusions reached of a match were just not based on sound science.
And my understanding is that this whole scandal was born because there were three men convicted, and then they were exonerated in part based upon this kind of faulty, erroneous FBI hair examiner testimony. And then you had the Innocence Project, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, teaming up with the FBI, to their credit, to review, I think, 500 cases so far?
Well, they have 1,200 more to go. In the hair area. I mean, I think they narrowed it down to like 2,500, but not all of them were trials, and some there was no testimony about the hair evidence ultimately, or there was a plea, and so in some cases there's no biological evidence left, which is also problematic. So, you know, the numbers are inexact. I mean, they say they have 1,200 more to go in this particular area that they're looking at. But the story, you know, is out there now, even though they've been working on this for a while. The Washington Post also exposed some problems in an article in 2012, which regarding hair analysis, which apparently prompted, you know, at least it was a part of the impetus behind the current investigation.
Do we know, Beth, whether any innocent people have been executed based upon this type of erroneous FBI witness statements concerning microscopic hair comparison evidence?
That's not a conclusion that I have seen anyone reach. However, the idea that an innocent person receives the ultimate penalty is something that, you know, we should all lose sleep over. But I haven't seen anyone reach that conclusion. What they're saying, though, is that death sentences have been handed down based in part on this flawed evidence, and executions have been carried out. Whether or not they're actually innocent, I don't know the answer to that. But
how many convictions are affected by this scandal to date?
Oh, nobody. It's mind-boggling, the potential, but nobody has a number right now because they're just going case by case. There are no, you know, numbers. I mean, it could be thousands. Ultimately, right now, I mean, they're saying they know of the 268 trials reviewed so far. 32 defendants were sentenced to death. 14 were executed or died in prison. You know, they're notifying 46 states and the District of Columbia also to look for, you know, these cases, do some reviews, and see if there are any grounds for appeals.
You're listening to Talking Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Beth Karras of KarrasOnCrime.com concerning the recent FBI acknowledgement of errors in their microscopic hair comparison testimony over perhaps hundreds of cases, perhaps thousands of cases. Beth, do we know what effect this will have on the states? Because my understanding is that the FBI hair comparison examiners trained a lot of the state experts who in turn testified in state trials.
That's right. I mean, hopefully states are stepping up. Texas, New York, and North Carolina are reviewing their hair examiner cases, according to the reports I've read, and also another 15 states are doing the same, but not all are doing it. And what the states need to do, though, is to perhaps recognize that they or add a grounds for appeal or sort of ignore the procedural rules right now that might prevent an appeal. If it is determined that there has been flawed testimony that at least contributed to someone's conviction, to give them a due process, a violation of due process grounds for appeal because of that. I mean, that's a change that may be slow to come. I mean, the science is moving fast and demanding changes, but, you know, the law doesn't move as quickly.
And the FBI, Beth, claims that to date, in 2015, this microscopic hair comparison error scandal is not a factor anymore because they say now they're using mitochondrial DNA testing to
right.
see if there's a match between hair at the scene and hair on a suspect.
Right. They'll still use a visual hair comparison to rule out, but if you're going to rule in, you don't use that visual hair comparison anymore. You do DNA testing. So that's since 2000. So that's good in the last 15 years or so. But the FBI did implement these standards for the labs for hair comparison since 2012. I mean, and you know, there was a report issued in 2009 by the National Academies on strengthening forensic science, the National Research Council, of which Marvin Schechter is a member. And this, it's really a book, hardcover book. And the Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings based on this report, and it has asked for a total revision of lab standards, accreditation, just across the board. There are little labs, you know, little state labs, and not just the federal labs that are problematic, but you need to have some uniformity here. But states need to be educated, and states make their own decisions. So it's a real problem. I mean, what could cause... Yeah, what may be admissible in one state may not be necessarily in another.
Well, I think this is really tragic, not only for those defendants whose convictions are based on faulty, erroneous, exaggerated expert testimony from government forensic experts, but also for the public, because this just erodes confidence in our criminal justice system. I mean, it's outrageous that from 1972 to 1999, this went on and the judges didn't figure it out. The government didn't figure it out. I guess, I don't know, the defense bar, which is at a disadvantage because a lot of times we don't have the information, didn't figure it out. It just seems like the whole system really dropped the ball on this.
Well, most of the participants you're talking about are not scientists, and so you kind of rely on the experts who, you know more than you do, and you just assume when they lay out their background that they know what they're talking about. But, you know, it's, you know, anyway, it's a problem. It's a major problem.
It is, and what was that old rock band that had that song about check the parking meters? But it reminds me of that anyway. I won't sing. To spare everybody that. Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Thank you so much, as always, Beth. I will speak to you next week, I hope.
Great. All right. Take care.
Thank you, Beth. Now, I want to say thank you to Alan Rosenthal of the Center for Community Alternatives. Please check out their website at communityalternatives.org. Go check out Beth Karas' subscription website for all the latest inside legal news, KarasOnCrime.com. I want to thank my producer, Mark Goldman, who always does such a fantastic job for us. Next week, Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., we will interview former Congressman Barney Frank, who will talk to us about his new book, Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. That will be a frank discussion. I couldn't help myself. What can I tell you? Please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Email me at talkinlaw@gmail.com, talkinlaw@gmail.com, no G in talking. And follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. I want to wish everyone peace and justice. Take care. Barney Frank next week.